WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg says it's not how many words a culture has for a particular thing that defines the subtleties of that culture's expression, but how well those words are used.
A recent editorial in the New York Times mentioned the 100 Eskimo words for snow. Shortly after that, there was an item in the same newspaper's science section that put the figure at 48. I suppose the specific number doesn't really matter. Everybody knows there are a lot of them. Well, actually, the Standard Dictionary of West Greenlandic Eskimo lists exactly two roots for snow: konik, which means snow in the air, and aput, which means snow on the ground. This is no big deal. It's like our distinction between rain and water. Other varieties of Eskimo may have a few more roots than this, but no more than English does with our snow, sleet, and slush. It's true that either language lets you make as many distinctions as you like. You can talk about wet snow, dry snow, packed snow, or the snows of yesteryear, but you don't need separate words to do it with. I owe this revelation to a couple of recent papers by the anthropologist Laura Martin and the linguist Jeff Pullum. They've been waging a lonely crusade to put the kibosh on the great Eskimo snow job. Martin has traced the story back to a misinterpretation of a casual remark by the turn-of-the-century anthropologist Franz Boas. Somehow, the idea caught the public fancy and entered the great amorphous body of linguistic folklore. Probably part of the appeal of the story is that we'll believe just about anything about Eskimos. They rub noses, lend their wives to strangers, leave their old people out to freeze. Certainly, it would be hard to get away with telling this kind of tale about a less exotic people, that the French have 13 words for cuckold, or that the Anglo-Saxons had 21 different ways of saying disembowel. But I suspect the real reason people like this story is for what it's supposed to prove about language. The more words you have for something, the more subtleties you're capable of, and the finer your perception. So we set our students to improving their word power with vocabulary lists, and we confidently explain that English is superior to all other languages because it is supposed to have more words than they do. Of course, a specialized vocabulary can be useful. Decorators and designers know a lot more different color words than most people do, and they don't mind your knowing it. I asked the salesman at Macy's, "How much are those brown trousers on the counter?" He looked at me as if he were considering a mustard stain on his herringbone and said, "Oh, you mean the taupe." But distinctions are not necessarily a good thing to have. You can lose sight of the big picture. For example, English has a remarkably large number of words to describe physical beauty. Things can be beautiful, pretty, gorgeous, lovely, attractive, handsome, cute, and so on. Whereas Italian does the same work with just one word, bello, sometimes with a little help from a suffix, as in bellino or bellissimo. So we should pity the poor Italians, whose language doesn't allow them to make all the subtle aesthetic distinctions that English is capable of. Except that then you look at their paintings in sports jackets and compare them to our paintings in sports jackets, and you realize that something is terribly wrong with this theory. The crucial thing about language isn't its power to make distinctions, but its power to generalize. Nature comes at us in an infinity of different categories, and we need words to fold them together. What's remarkable is not that a language has many words for snow, as that English makes do with so few. Think of it, a crusted meadow under the distant glitter of a January sun, flakes swirling in the cone of a street lamp, the sooty heaps along West End Avenue dotted with dog turds, all comprehended in a single syllable.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California.